Did you see, you know, Blur have done all these reunions recently?
Yeah, yeah.
And their bassist, Alex James, got into trouble recently. Or actually, it wasn't recently at all. It was like years ago. He got into trouble because he got pictured with Jeremy Clarkson and David Cameron.
Right.
And people who listened to Blur were like, no way am I listening to Blur if you support the Tories. And he said in an NME interview or something, he was like, oh, that was a really unfortunate picture. Please still listen to us.
It is like that Johnny Marr thing, though, when Cameron was trying to claim that he really liked the Smiths. Marr was like, fuck off. You cannot like the Smiths. You're not allowed.
Oh, that was classic.
So this, in awkward segue fashion, is the Right Dishonourable podcast. As you can probably tell, Jazza is not with us this week.
He's either in... that or his voice has got weirder.
Weirder. Even weirder than it normally is. He is in Russia doing something. I'm not really sure what. But today I've got with me John, who writes for the site. You might have read some of his content already.
John, I hope so, yeah.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name's John. I'm a freelance writer. I've got a blog called Donkey OK, which I started. I thought that was really funny because my second name's Cervantian. Don Quixote, but Donkey OK.
No, it's not going over.
I thought it'd be hilarious. It's turning out to be shit. But you can follow me on Twitter.
Yeah, but John's been writing for us for a month or so, is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
And I thought we'd bring him on the show just to sort of have a discuss about the latest issues of the week. The main one of which is the budget, which George Osborne, the Chancellor and Conservative Party luminary, unveiled this week to much controversy, though, particularly around the what he branded the living wage. What a lot of people say is not, in fact, a living wage. And also this thing about maintenance grants.
Students hate him right now. What bastards.
So that's the first thing we'll be talking about. And the second thing, John?
The second thing is Tim Hunt, the UCL professor. He's a physics professor. I forget what he specialises in, but he's apparently a Nobel Prize winner.
He is, and he's also a knight as
He's
well.
Also a knight. Yeah, God, yeah, Sir Tim Hunt. And he was fired by UCL. Well, he actually resigned, and this week it came out that UCL weren't going to take him back.
Yeah, UCL had a meeting and said, we're definitely not going to reinstate him.
I should clarify, because I haven't said this at all. Right, the reason he resigned was he said something sexist.
Yeah, we assumed that you'd already know that. So we'll be discussing a little bit about that. And the third topic, which... a bit sort of weirder for us than usual. There's been a lot of chat around the various Labour leaders and, you know, who's winning, who's got the backing of various unions and various regional Labour groups and that sort of thing. But we're going to be presenting you with an alternative list of potential Labour leaders.
Yeah, I think it's Labour First? We're sort of trying to get people not to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. So I just thought, right, it'd be fun if we talked about an alternative.
Indeed.
List of Labour people.
So we'll be doing that. If you like what we do, remember to like check out the website rightdishonourable.com. Follow us on Twitter @rightdishonour. We probably should have a Facebook page now, but we don't. And look us up on YouTube because we have a lot of old content there as well. So hope you enjoy the podcast, and you know, see you after the break. Okay, so in the last week, George Osborne, the Tory Chancellor of the current administration, laid out his plans in his budget for the next year, what he's going to cut, the new tax incentives he's going to put in place. And the broad picture is that he took with one hand while giving with the other. So, for instance, he's unveiled plans to raise the minimum wage and what he's calling a living wage, but I think we agree isn't really a living wage. But by the same token, he's also reducing tax credits, which has led a lot of people to speculate that people are going to be worse off. The people on minimum wage will by and large be worse off after this. So, John, we've been discussing a little bit about some of the measures in place. You've written an article on maintenance grants, which are being cut and replaced for student loans. How do you feel about how the whole budget went?
I think the main thing to take away from the budget... there are some good things that even Labour have come out and said, you know, it was a lot of things that had been pinched. But the main thing to take away from the budget is the very next day, Institute of Fiscal Studies came out with a study that said, everybody's fucked.
Everybody?
Everybody's like... fucked. Unless you're sort of very middle class. And I think the only people that are going to do quite well out of this, apparently, if like you're a couple who are both in employment where you're earning over £15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a niche bunch of people, really. Apparently, everybody...
I mean, I think that's about 30k salary in real terms. It would be above that.
Yeah, yeah. So you basically, you've got to be sort of a high earner, probably in a sort of cosmopolitan lifestyle anyway, to do well out of this budget. The sort of working poor are really screwed by this.
So is it fair to say that this has been a class war budget?
Yeah, like your social mobility is just gone now, hasn't it? Basically, the Tories have kind of said, well, for our first budget, what we want to do is take the whole idea of social mobility and say no, no more.
Why do you think they're doing that then?
I think basically because it leaves them in a position of power. It creates this dynamic where the rich people stay rich, poor people stay poor, middle people kind of stay in the middle, slash middle people might get a bit richer. So essentially they're freezing everything.
But I mean, we don't think the Tories are evil necessarily. I don't think they're all evil.
No, like this. See, this is the thing. I mean, they've obviously nicked some good policies. The idea of a living wage, in and of itself, is a cool idea because people need it.
I mean, interestingly though, he did say that when he's raising the minimum wage, which is effectively what he's doing for over 25s, it's going to be booted up to £7.20 by April 2016. By 2020, it's going to be £9. He also said that in doing this, 60,000 jobs would be lost, because one of the effects of raising the minimum wage is that people who would be able to sell their labour for below the minimum wage are obviously no longer able to, because it effectively becomes illegal. So in a way, could you not say that it's actually raising the minimum wage is also harming a certain section of society?
Yeah, I think it's a problem for small businesses as well. Like their excuse for not bumping it straight up to £9 an hour was that small businesses won't be able to cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that, I suppose, in theory. I think the sort of problem is, though, that, you know, so whatever you think of the welfare program at the moment that the country's currently got, and yeah, it's very easy to argue that it's unsustainable. He said that he wants to make 12 billion of cuts, but he has said, don't worry about it because I've bumped up, you know, the minimum wage to a living wage. So it's all going to level out. It doesn't. Apparently the figures show that this living wage is going to add sort of 4 billion to the pockets of, you know, like the average
people on minimum
wage. Yeah, the people on minimum wage. But so there's still like an 8 billion deficit. There's a drop of sort of £8 billion that is going to, over the course of the parliament, affect these people.
So the other thing that the Tories have done in this budget, which also affects young people, I mentioned earlier, the living, quote, living wage, is only applies for people over 25. The other thing the Tories have done is to cut maintenance grants. It used to be that you could apply for a maintenance grant of £3,800. And now you'll be able to draw a loan, but you're actually allowed to, the loan will be on the same terms as student loans currently are. But you'll be able to draw, I think it's north of £8,000 for sort of living costs.
Yeah, they've
basically
bumped it up basically. So they've essentially taken what you would have, in broad terms, they've taken what you would have had for the grant and just tacked it onto what you can get as a maintenance loan now. So that's what they've done. Of course, the big distinction being that when you had a grant, you didn't have to pay it back. Now that there are loans, you do have to pay it back.
But I suppose the argument they would make is, why should somebody who doesn't go to university pay for someone else to go to university, potentially?
I actually think the problem with this, to come at it from like a different slant, I think the problem is, they were talking on Question Time the other night, right? There were some crazy people in the audience on Question Time, but some of them had...
As per usual.
So somebody brought up the fact that, like, too many people go to university, there are degrees that aren't really worth an awful lot. They're no good to anybody.
This was actually the Kipper lady, Louise Bors, I believe her name is. She's a UKIP MEP, I think, from somewhere in the north. She said, what was the phrase? David Beckham studies.
Yeah, David Beckham studies. Which, I mean, I personally haven't heard of like a degree in David Beckham, whatever.
I believe it exists.
I can believe that there's a course in it. The point being, though, that actually we need better apprenticeships. Because let's face it, it's a brutal truth that nobody wants to acknowledge. It's that some people can't make it to university or they have no business being there because essentially they're too stupid. I know that's like, don't get me wrong, I know that's really close to like a sort of eugenics argument. But some people are literally, you put a stack of books in front of them and say you've got to read this and take an exam at the end. They're not going to make it through the first one.
Well, I suppose the other way of putting it is, which is maybe a slightly kinder way, is that some people don't really get on with academics.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly. It's some bit, and, you know, again, it's a horrible thing to admit, but it's true.
Well, if you go and chat to any teacher and you say, do you have some students that you know just won't be able to get top marks in your class, whatever you
exactly.
do, they'll tell you yes.
And the world, sadly, needs remedial jobs. Like, if everybody become, you know, some people talk about living in this sort of utopian society where everybody is wonderfully educated and understands, you know, neoliberal theories and how consumer markets work and all these, you know, ideas that in general the intelligentsia understands. It's unrealistic because if that's the case, who's going to be, you know, cleaning up sick in sort of hospitals and stuff like that?
I guess the argument would be robots, you know.
Until we get to, I mean, yeah, obviously that, but then you've got the whole like Terminator 2/iRobot argument that they'll probably just rise up and kill us all anyway.
But you've got that, like, the whole, what you talked about is about, it's kind of about class in a way and about social hierarchy, which in a way is what the Tories are aiming towards with this budget.
Well, yeah, but okay, to sort of get back to my point. So some people are not, there's no point them going to university, because if you're going to university, why would you bother basically going to university to study David Beckham studies? It's not going to get you far in life. Why don't you go do an apprenticeship? And the reason people aren't doing apprenticeships at the moment is because there aren't good apprenticeships out there.
Do we feel that the Tories are basically just tinkering with the numbers and, you know, the money and not really pushing through the reforms, the real tangible reforms such as house building programmes or educational reforms such as you've just discussed? Do we feel they've got their priorities all wrong? I realise this is a budget, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think they, a lot of what they've done is sort of stunting. It's stunted social mobility. And, you know, it's the thing like the housing. So they've put up the limit for...
Yes, basically they've pushed for an inheritance tax reform. It used to be that if your house was worth more than 600,000 or something like that, then when you died, you would be your... what's the word? The people in your will would be taxed on the value of your house. They still are, but the threshold for being taxed is now £1 million. So the house has to be worth £1 million or more before that tax kicks in.
I mean, that's a real kick in the nuts, isn't it? To people who are affected badly by this budget. Like, one of the only good things that, you know, a sort of section of society is going to be really happy about are rich people who can leave their kids expensive houses. Versus loads of different working tax credits have been taken away. I think it's that in itself is kind of symptomatic of, yeah, what you were talking about, priorities being a bit out of whack, really.
Well, the craziest thing to me, and this has been a recurring theme throughout Osborne's chancellery, is that what he's doing in the inheritance tax thing is stoking the housing market even more. So houses, apart from being things that people live in, are an asset class. They're things that people invest in. And what he has done is make that asset class more attractive. So he will have increased the demand for houses by reducing the inheritance tax. And that, for me, is just utterly crazy in a country that has a chronic housing shortage. You know, whatever it is you plan on doing, the worst thing to possibly do when you have a lack of housing is to encourage people to buy more houses, which is what he's done with the inheritance tax reform.
Yeah, well, apparently he didn't commit to nearly enough new builds either, did he?
Yeah, I can believe that. I mean, the Tories seem to have no plans whatsoever for actually sorting out the housing problem.
Yeah, which, again, it doesn't help with the whole sort of idea of social mobility, really. I mean, you can get into arguments about whether people actually need houses, because I would argue from a...
From an eco-warrior perspective.
From a sort of eco-warrior perspective, that people are really, really greedy with this and kind of don't need houses. I know, obviously, some... Don't get me wrong, everybody needs a roof over their head, but... Flats are actually really attractive.
Do you mean they don't need to own property, or that they don't need to own a house?
No, I'm just saying that they don't need to own a house. Like, flats are actually really attractive in some ways. Perfect for if you live in any kind of urban area. Very low maintenance. People have got this kind of stigma against sort of high-rise buildings, as if, you know, God, why would you want a flat when you can have a house? Well, because... You don't need a house. You don't need that many
rooms.
There
have been studies, though, that suggest that if you spend a lot of time in a high-rise building, say, like, if you work in a high-rise building or you live in a high-rise building, it actually makes you unhappy.
Yeah, but that's probably because of the social construct of it as well. Because you're probably thinking, oh, well, I don't have a house, rather than just saying, well, I've got a flat. I should be happy about having a flat.
Is there no element of nature that's possible in that?
Well, I obviously, you know, if we go to like a sort of anthropological argument, we should all be out in fields sort of rubbing our heads against each other's genitals and and stuff like that.
I'm not sure I want to know where you're going with this.
Running around.
So the last thing that is probably worth covering the budget, now that we've done maintenance grants and the so-called living wage and the inheritance tax thing, is to discuss the ring fencing of the defence budget. Britain has a commitment to NATO to actually spend 2% of its GDP on military. You know, there doesn't seem to be a lot of directions about what sort of equipment you have to buy or where you have to put that money, but you do have to invest that amount of money. In the past, we've been gradually approaching a period where we may not have been investing enough. I don't think we dropped below the amount that was necessary, but there were concerns, particularly from Washington in the US, that we would not spend enough money on defence, and that would affect the collective security of Europe. Most of Europe is part of NATO, but the European NATO members, by and large, do not spend enough money on defence as per the obligation. But Osborne, in this budget, has said we will spend 2% of our GDP on defence, and that is now a ring fence commitment, at least until he changes his mind. There will be no more cuts to the military. What do you kind of make of this as a move?
My take on this is that the public are idiots.
And okay, isn't that your take on most
situations? It's my take on most situations, but specifically in terms of defence, the public are idiots because... A lot of people were very upset about the Iraq War, which I understand a lot, because, you know, we went in and didn't find any WMDs, etc. Fast forward to the whole Syria crisis. So much pressure gets put on MPs by their constituents not to intervene that a humanitarian crisis has gone on for far too long. We could have intervened and helped stop... I'm sure will one day come to be looked on as a genocide by the Syrian government. We could have intervened to stem that. So, and we're to blame for that. The public are to blame for that, because we don't want to get involved in any more foreign wars. My point being with this kind of stuff, that I don't think public opinion on defence budgets, etc., is in many ways a good idea, because I think we flip-flop too much.
The obvious other implication of the defence spending is around Russia and about what happened in Crimea over the past couple of years. Do we feel that, you know, a hike in defence spending is actually going to alter that substantially?
No, I think the only thing that's going to alter that substantially is paying somebody a lot of money to pretend they're not a UK citizen, give them a sniper rifle, send them to Moscow and hope for the best.
I mean, it sounds as though what you're saying there is you don't think there will be a solution forthcoming around the Ukraine.
No, I don't think that. I think it's eventually where we will give in, as will most other Western countries. We'll stop caring about it because other more pressing matters will come up. Vladimir Putin will probably get even crazier until he dies. He'll do more and more crazy shit.
I mean, I'm not sure quite how we've got from the budget to Vladimir Putin, but I think this is probably a good time to wrap up this segment. If you have any thoughts on any of the weird and wonderful topics we've gone into in this, do send them to us in the comments via Twitter, via YouTube, all the usual avenues. And in the next segment, we will be discussing Tim Hunt and his allegedly sexist remarks that were made around women in science.
Right, so the second thing we're going to talk about is Sir Tim Hunt, who is a Nobel laureate in physics at UCL, and he was fired...
Formerly of UCL.
Formerly, oh my God, yeah, formerly of UCL. He was fired for saying the following. This is a conference of science journalists. Let me tell you about the trouble with girls. Three things happen when they're in the lab. You fall in love with them, they fall in love with you, and when you criticise them, they cry. So we should
say that the reason we're bringing up this story again is that UCL have just decided not to reinstate him. There was some sort of council meeting of, you know, elders and superiors and whatnot. Yeah. And they've finally said, despite the fact they've been widely criticised, that they're not going to bring him back.
We should point out that they didn't actually fire him, did they? He resigned, and they've said basically that they're accepting his resignation. He's not going to be reinstated.
So he resigned, but there's a very strong indication that he was pushed.
Oh, yeah.
His wife even said that somebody phoned them up and said, if you don't resign, we will fire you.
Well, he said, apparently he told BBC4, BBC Radio 4, that he was really sorry that he said it in front of journalists, but that he meant what he said.
So what do you make of this whole thing? Because the remark you said, it does, like you read out at the start, it does sound bad, but he also goes on to say in that BBC
article... He does say that that he did say to the BBC that he meant it sort of ironically, but that he has had trouble in the past with women falling in love with people in labs.
Falling in love with him, specifically.
Yeah, yeah, so... obviously, he was trying to make a joke about something that's probably happened to him personally. There's probably like a horrible bit of pain. Maybe there's been an affair that's been had in the lab.
So there's two sides to this story. The one side is what he said and whether or not you think that's outrageous. The other side is the whole reaction to it and the media furore and him being fired or, you know, him having to resign effectively.
So I know it's a controversial view. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a feminist through and through, and I don't think these kind of things should be said. And I do think that it's ridiculous. You just know that I'm about to dig myself a grave. But it doesn't actually detract from the fact that he is a Nobel laureate physicist and probably should stay and teach, you know, up-and-coming physicists. Because although he's clearly a bit of a bigot and a bit crazy, like aren't all sort of professors? Like when I was at university, I knew some people said some things to me that they should never have got away with. They should have been. I mean, I did a poetry class once where, for using the word nan in a poem, somebody said to me, "This makes you sound like a snot-nosed council estate chav." Which is, like, again, just not okay. You should never say that.
I should say, for the avoidance of doubt, it is not the opinion of the Right Dishonourable that Sir Tim is a bigot. However, I think that, I mean, it's an interesting argument that you bring up, and it's one that we have actually written about in the past, and a bunch of other publications have written about, is the sense these days that if you have slightly eccentric or, say, old-fashioned views about certain things, you are no longer allowed to express them if you are in a position of power or in a position of influence.
Yeah.
And I personally feel that he shouldn't have been fired, and actually this whole controversy, which is one of many controversies that have happened over the past couple of years, they don't really mean anything. You know, somebody says something a bit inappropriate or somebody says something and it comes off badly and these people just get their lives ruined, basically. They lose jobs, you know, they...
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of easy for us to say because, you know, we weren't one of the attacked parties. Last time I checked, we both have penises, so
We don't check all that often.
Yeah, well, we don't check all that often, but... we weren't accused of being the ones who cried in labs and fell in love with people. But I you know, it's different if he was working at a high school or something, where, you know, people are impressionable because they're growing up, their views are sort of forming, and a sexist teacher should be fired because they could bring up, you know, sexist teenagers. By the time you're at university, if you're going to hear a professor say something sexist, then you're not just going to go, yeah, he says some mad stuff every now and again, but his calculations are really good, so we put up with it. You shouldn't really be at university because your mental faculties clearly aren't, you know, good enough to be discerning. So I feel sorry for the guy in the sense that I think he should have come out. I think he should have made a better apology than he did. But I think he should have come out, made an apology, and they should have said, right, well, you know, you're obviously sexist. We feel very sorry for your wife, but here's your job back.
So do we feel like UCL have not responded well to this whole incident? That they really should be, the blame should be on them around this whole thing?
The problem is, from their point of view, what are they going to do? Because if they didn't fire him, everybody would... I mean, can you imagine? Like, the female students in that university alone would probably tear the place a new arsehole. They wouldn't have a library left. Like, the books would get burned, equipment would get smashed. I understand, you know, righteous anger or whatever, but my point being that there's nothing else UCL could do, really. Because people would, you know, just get so angry about it.
Universities are supposed to be bastions of free speech, free thought, yeah, and criticism, but, and, you know.
But only when it's progressive. Like, I don't get me wrong, I'm not sort of saying that universities shouldn't be progressive spaces, but it's like that controversy over not letting radical Muslim clerics, you know, go and debate people in sort of philosophy seminars or whatever.
Or that incident where two men were debating abortion in some university and there was a protest to get it shut down because
exactly.
There are no women on the panel.
Exactly. Yeah, universities should be progressive spaces, but how do you define what is a progressive space if you never allow incursions from more sort of conservative views?
I'm not sure universities should be progressive as such. I'm not really sure they should have a political agenda beyond what I previously said about, you know, stimulating thought and that sort of thing, and ultimately fulfilling their remit as research institutions and that sort of thing. But we obviously both agree that this entire scenario, this situation is ridiculous, but I'm wondering if you feel that there are certain comments where you would say, okay, that is too far. Because this is what we're discussing now is obviously pretty mild. I'm sure most feminists would even agree. Yeah, you know, it's a bit sexist, but it's not like there's no viciousness in here, really.
Yeah, I mean,
really.
I think the thing is he didn't incite any hate, did he? I mean, if he said, the problem with women in labs is they just shouldn't be there. Next time you see a woman, slap her like we did in the 50s. If he said something ridiculous like that, yeah, get rid of him. But he didn't sort of say, go slap your girlfriend. He said,
For you, the distinction is inciting violence or...
Yeah, I think if you say something that is going to potentially have a sort of real detrimental effect on it, I don't mean as in you said somebody has a big nose and therefore they go away crying. I mean, if you said something like, The problem with physics is there are too many black people. Black people should not practice physics. If you said something like...
What he said, though, sounded a lot to me like women should not be involved in science. I mean, that would be the obvious inference from what he was saying. Or, you know, they shouldn't be involved in the same lab as men.
I don't think he really meant that. I don't see how you can be a self-respecting physicist and really... like say that, because you've got layers of inspirational female scientific
people. We should add that after he said these remarks, he did go on to say how important women were in science, and he, you know, praised that side of things. So I don't really think there is a suggestion that he really has a massive problem with women, but the way it's been kind of interpreted, as I just interpreted it then, is that the trouble with girls, therefore there shouldn't be girls in the lab, which is probably not what he meant. Is there anything more we can say about this? I mean, it's just such a flimsy, weird, ridiculous story. And I mean, we're partly adding to this problem of oversaturation of media coverage. But as I said, I feel this is a ongoing problem. There have been a number of incidents in this vein.
Yeah, I think the important thing to take away from this is leave eccentrics alone. Like, there are some crazy people in universities, but they do good work. You know, I think your person, if you're an academic, you're clearly not a very sociable person, are you? You like, you
just
like
defaming
books.
The entirety of academia.
No,
now.
But it's true. You know, I'm still at university. If you're, you know, somebody who can put up with that amount of reading, it's because you don't really like people that much.
Possibly
you
true.
you sort of prefer your imaginary friends in books or on, you know, chalk tables or whatever. So yeah, of course these people are going to come out with ridiculous weird stuff because, you know, they're not sociable people. We should probably leave them alone, basically, to a degree, unless they say something really racist or hateful, in which case pitchfork them.
So racism is not okay, but sexism, like bit light sexism, is fine.
No. God, you're gonna get me so many hate emails. No, like I mean, racism, serious sexism that's like go slap women or whatever,
incitement to violence,
anything that incites hatred. I don't think what he said actually incites hatred. I think it's sexist. I don't think it actually incites sexism or incites hatred towards women. I think that's the distinction. If he says something that is sort of, you know, basically very provocative to a level where it could influence somebody to go and be sexist, I think that's unacceptable. I think
surely that's like a very, you know, difficult thing to test for.
Don't get me wrong, it's very subjective, but I think in the context you should take it on a case by case basis.
So long as what he says is within the law, then.
Yeah, I think
At least in regards to this particular topic.
Yeah. I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. And I think in this case, he should have had a massive slap on the wrists, but I don't think he should have lost his job.
So, if you have, you know, any opinions about this, which I'm sure you do, if you're outraged at John and want to send him some sort
please
of hate
message...
Please don't
firebomb me.
Then, you know, just leave your comments. Get in touch with us via Twitter, via YouTube as well. And... in the next segment, we will be covering alternative Labour leaders. John has a list prepared for us.
Oh, God, do
because I. We're not entirely impressed with the current selection. So, on that note, I'll see you after the break. So in this final segment of this episode of The Right Dishonourable, we are going to discuss some alternatives for the Labour leadership candidacy. Because as it stands now, there's four relatively uninspiring leaders. You have Andy Burnham, Liz Kendall, Yvette Cooper, and Jeremy Corbyn, who's sort of the outsiders.
Basically Labour's version of Uncle Albert or something, really.
Well, you know, the I want to say left wing, left of field candidate, Jeremy Corbyn. But we've compiled a list here, or John has compiled a list, of five alternatives to the Labour leadership. And we're just going to run through these suggestions. If you come up with your, you know, your own alternatives, feel free to put them in the comments and obviously say what you think of our list. So, John, who's the first candidate on your list?
So this is obviously in a universe where any of this can be possible.
Yeah.
Because most of these are impossible. I'll admit that at the top. Just actually, though, incidentally, so I was sort of going through people who exist who are female. And
Who exist that are female? Yeah. Women, you mean?
Women. So I was going through, like, different lists of female celebrities who are outspoken Labour supporters. And there aren't an awful lot of them. There's Delia Smith, who everybody knows is the person who puts cream in everything. There's Joe...
That's not a euphemism.
Yeah, oh God. There's oh man. There's very good. There's Joe Brand, who is just really miserable.
We weren't sure about Charlotte Church as well. And
we
couldn't
Charlotte
be bothered
Church.
To Google it, so.
But basically I think actually this might be a media problem, is that when a male celebrity is interviewed, they might say, "Oh, by the way, who are you going to vote for?" But when it's a woman, they'll just probably quite sexistly say, "So, what shoes are you going to wear tomorrow?"
I mean, that might be true, but on the other hand, the Labour leadership contest, as I've just said, is mostly there's two women. There was a previous woman called Mary Cray who drops out, but
yeah,
she was a contender for a fair amount of time. And of the three frontrunners, two of them are women.
I think, so. Yeah, like, and I think obviously we've got the highest number of female MPs now that we've ever had.
It's a third of Parliament is
which
female.
Is, you know, it's still not, I suppose, representational, but we're moving in the right direction, basically. But I just thought it was interesting trying to look this up, that there aren't basically enough female supporters of politics in general.
So, on that note,
on that bombshell,
who is the first candidate on your list?
So, number five... I've tried to play to a sort of different demographics of your listeners by the introduction to this
one. Okay.
So some of your listeners will know him from the Twilight series. Other people will know him from Masters of Sex. And some might even know him for playing Tony Blair. I'm talking about Michael Sheen.
Okay, so why is Michael Sheen an appropriate candidate for
right,
Labour leadership?
First, he's Welsh. Which means that if he gets into any serious trouble in the Commons, he can sing down the opposition.
Have you tested his singing skills?
No, but
we ascertain this?
In general, Welsh people are thought to have very good singing voices.
That's
so
true.
I'm going to go with that as fact.
I'm convinced. I mean, what are the potential problems with him as Labour leader?
That he's a bit too much of a chameleon. So one day he'll come in character as Tony Blair.
Do you think that might cause a bit of upset in the Labour Party?
Well, yeah, so, you know, the days he comes in as Tony Blair could cause a bit of upset on or support on some...
might split the party.
It will split the party. And then the next day, he'll come in as David Frost, and people won't know what they're dealing with, because he'll just be all really suave and charming.
Yeah, especially
because
David Frost is dead, so that might upset people.
Exactly, that's going to really freak people out. And he'll probably... It depends on what age he goes with for his David Frost sort of impersonation as well, because he might just sit with the sort of blanket over the legs and dribble a lot.
Wow. Okay, so swiftly moving on, who is the second person on your list?
Emma Watson. So my only real reason for putting this down is that she'd get quite a lot of support. She did that speech at the UN, which personally I thought This whole episode has made me sound really sexist as well. I'm genuinely not, but I kind of thought the Emma Watson speech was a bit she said some things. I think you summed it up quite well. She said some things that were really obvious, and then she went and said some things which just had no real relevance.
Well, she said some things that were obvious, some things that were kind of questionable. And I mean, it just seemed to me to be a kind of masturbatory display.
Well, I mean, whenever you preface something with, "Hi, I know I'm only an actress and I probably shouldn't be talking about this," I immediately go, "Well, then why are you?"
But that said, you still put her on your list.
I've put her on my list because, let's face it, she'd get a massive female vote if she ever decided to be an MP.
I think she'd get a fair proportion of the
she'd
men
get
on board
well, yeah,
as well.
She'd get a.
So she's more photogenic than your average politician.
She's more photogenic, and I mean, like, apparently not enough women vote. I haven't checked the stats on this, but apparently less women vote than men is what I heard.
Oh.
Could be completely wrong. If I am, very sorry. But apparently that's true, so I think she'd sort of stimulate more female voting.
But apart from her, you know, femaleness and the Harry Potter thing, I mean, politically, how are we feeling about Emma Watson? I mean, she's got the feminist thing going on, but...
Well, apparently she's quite intelligent, because she got into Cambridge.
She's definitely smart. I mean, she played Hermione Granger, so she, you know...
The questionable thing, I suppose, is that she apparently dropped out of university, so... I don't know, maybe she's not all she's cracked up to be.
Okay.
So actually, this has become a real, like, I should have put her in number five, because, yeah, this has just been...
So you actually feel like, you feel that Michael Sheen really should be bumped up to number
basically,
four.
Basically, Michael Sheen at number four. We're going to put Emma Watson down at number
right,
five.
Right, so already two of the candidates have changed place. Who is number three on your
right,
list?
Number three, I've put down Benedict Cumberbatch.
Do you want to explain why you've put down
well,
Benedict?
Reason number one is that he would Sherlock the shit out of being a PM.
Do you want that level of attention to detail, though, in a PM? Because you have to have quite a broad perspective.
I just like the idea that he might sort of go into his own little headspace every now and again in sort of PMQs and just say, "I must first say this to destroy the argument, then this, then remind him of family death." He will sit back down and cry.
I would definitely make PMQs a lot more interesting.
It would. I reckon he'd be really quite dangerous. But on a serious note, he's campaigned for a lot of different social causes.
So he was actually part of the... I'm reading this off Wikipedia, if you haven't guessed. Part of the Stop the War coalition. He's identified himself as a straight ally and has officiated in the same-sex marriage of friends. That has at least two sources, so that must be true. And he's also described himself as a feminist, so...
There was a massive thing, wasn't there, when he was in Imitation Game. He basically was behind a massive campaign that demanded that there be royal pardons for anybody who was imprisoned, basically for being gay back when the country in general was homophobic. Well, the government was homophobic, I suppose. Which probably still are, but a bit more closeted about it now. Technically, you're not meant to be homophobic anymore.
I think we should maybe stop making unsubstantiated allegations against the government at this point. I mean, that is largely what this podcast is, but we don't want to.
We should move on to the next
one. Do you feel there's any downsides to Mr. Cumberbatch as a potential choice of Labour leader?
We'd lose him as an actor, I think, is the downside.
I don't think people would stand for that, really.
No, I don't think people would. You'd never be able to watch another episode of Sherlock, basically. And that's the other thing. It could all go horribly wrong, and then his whole body of work would stand for nothing because we'd all just hate him.
You mean he might end up sending us into, like, Iraq?
He could do something really horrible like that, and then, your sort of DVD box sets of Sherlock or your Blu-ray of the Intimidation Game or whatever just go straight in the bin and you hate him.
Okay, so, I mean, we're still happy with him at number three?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
think.
So who is number two on your list?
Russell Brand. If for nothing else than for the fact that he'd probably never turn up in a suit, which would immediately put people on a sort of, like, not sure how to deal with him.
I can see him in, like, a really nice, skinny, dapper suit, one of those kind of dandyish type of shirts as well, one with the kind of... I'm trying to, like...
Do you mean like the ones with the sort of frills or whatever?
Yeah, the one with the frills.
See, but
I
was thinking exactly the same thing just now. I thought if he went all out for a suit, he would come in basically looking like Prince.
It would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah. He would be ridiculous. I know he's Mr. Nobody Should Ever Vote, but he did come out in support of Labour at the last minute in the last vote.
I mean, it's not strong for a politician to tell people that they shouldn't be voting.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, he's clearly not as intelligent as he or most people think he is.
I think most people think he's not that intelligent, so...
Well, this is the weird thing. If you ever... Like, I've been to watch his stand-up, and he comes out with some amazing points about... He does quite a lot of sort of political satire and commentary. And when I went to see him, for example, he just had a stack of papers from that day and he made comments on loads of different articles. He's very aware of how the media manipulates people and things like that, which I think is always a good thing if somebody's discerning about...
It's certainly good for a politician to know
Well,
that.
Exactly. That can go either way. But I think it's good if... he doesn't want people to watch adverts as much, which I think is great.
I think that's great now, but it's because we have no adverts on the site, so I may revise my opinion.
Later down the line. Just retrospectively edit this.
Yeah.
I think he'd be interesting. One of the things he would have going for him would be that he's charismatic, and God knows the Labour Party need that.
That is true. But do you not find his political analysis oftentimes is quite shallow? As in, he'll look at a problem and go, this is the solution, and then you think, well, that probably wouldn't work because of X, Y, Z, and so on.
Yeah, but this is the perfect time for him to be a Labour leader. He's coming off the back of a guy who chiselled a fucking tombstone. I mean, how much more on the nose can you get? These are our promises. They're in a stone. These will be the Labour promises because they're written in stone. Russell Brand can piss it.
Okay, so happy with Russell Brand at number two. So who is your top pick for the alternative Labour leadership contest?
Controversial, for many reasons.
I mean, I'm fairly sure the other ones will not have been, uncontroversial. So
brace yourselves. I'm going with Boris Johnson. He's known to dissent every now and again from the sort of Tory party and the official policy. He's not afraid basically to talk out against things that he's not happy with, and he's I mean, the reason that people predict that after David Cameron steps down, that Boris Johnson will come in and sort of automatically walk into being the next Prime Minister is because he has an uncanny ability to turn Labour voters into Conservative voters. Apparently, like, it's unprecedented in the last 30 years of politics for somebody to get the kind of approval ratings that he manages.
So are you assuming that if he crosses the floor, which would be in line with one of his heroes, Churchill, who, you know, moved between the Liberal and the Tory parties back when the Liberals actually mattered, do you see him being able to recruit Tory voters to the Labour cause?
Easily. I think that's what would be, like, his big draw. There are people who would be sort of sat back, you know, sloshing their little tumbler of whiskey, going, "Boris has gone over to the Labour Party. Bloody good show. Let's give it a punt."
So, I mean, he's a social liberal guy, economically quite liberal, as in, you know, free markets and whatever. You know, sort of sits quite firmly on the Tory graph,
yeah,
side of the political spectrum. Is this not clashing with the, the mainstay of the Labour Party?
I mean, technically, yes. But again, they've just had Ed Miliband. And this is... look who we've got as like a... because we're talking about this as like alternative people. Jeremy Corbyn has come from being a rank outsider to a real threat for leader... A lot of people are now talking about it being between him and Andy Burnham. Like, that's a really shit choice. It's like choosing between your decrepit old uncle and your very bland...
And your northern cousin.
Your very bland northern cousin. Like, because, I mean, Andy Burnham, I think he's been in the military, hasn't he?
I don't think that's true.
I think most
of the Labour... Well, I think all of them are basically just full-time politicians, like career politicians.
Right, yeah.
I could be mistaken about
that. No, I'm probably getting my facts mixed up. But, Andy Burnham's pretty bland. Jeremy Corbyn is only popular because he keeps saying slightly controversial things and people are like, well, he's got personality at least.
So Boris Johnson, how likely do you think it is we can convince him to step in and take up the Labour mantle?
I think it really depends on whether he's allowed into... Actually, like, we joke about it. He's crazy enough to do something like this if he's not put into the cabinet, like when he finishes being Mayor of London.
I mean, 5 years' time, the Right Dishonourable called it first.
Yeah, know? 5 years' time. Definitely. He'd do crazy shit as well, like roll out Boris bikes for the entirety of the UK. Just puts a ban on all commuting unless you're on a bike.
So, on that final note, if you have any thoughts about our Labour leadership picks, and if you have any of your own, feel free to put them in the comments. Send them to us via Twitter, via YouTube, or the usual channels. And hopefully we will... You'll be hearing from us again in a week's time. John, thanks very much for being on the show.
Cheers. It's been a blast.
It's been a blast.
Sorry about the sexism. I'm not sexist, really. Anybody who has to say they're not sexist probably makes themselves sound more sexist, don't they? I'm going to get so much hate mail.
That may have to be cut for libel reasons. And then I'm just going to leave that in as a statement and people will wonder what the hell we just said.